If you're a fan of your garden, you may never think about your garden the same way. You are hopefully holding this country together, perhaps just with what you're growing in your backyard. Whole civilizations have fallen because of, or at least related to, the quality of their dirt. That's the subject of both tonight's guest and the book, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. We'll get back to some other examples of what we're talking about before we get to your questions and comments. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So I'm enjoying this quite a bit. And like I said, I'm sure many people have questions and comments. David Montgomery is the author of Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. I was just looking at a couple of pieces here I want to get to before too long, but let's just wrap up that other thought about some of the ways in which immigrant populations to the United States have been shaped by dirt. And I'm reminded of, although I didn't think I read this part yet in the book, about the Irish, because I always thought that was like a main part of their immigration, is what happened both with the feudal system of farming, as you were talking about earlier, the oligarchy that owned the property, and the fact that there just wasn't enough food for a population.
Well, and it also had, I mean, that the potato famine is a good, big part of the reason that the Montgomerys are in the U.S.
Right, exactly.
First we got kicked out of Scotland, then we had Ireland. And there were sort of two problems there. One was there's that problem that the amount of land that an individual sort of farming family had kept shrinking. And the classic example of that today really is Haiti, where as the generations have increased, just the amount of land per family has gone down to the point that food is, it's hard to come by. That kind of a process was happening in Ireland. But the other process that happened there was the problem of essentially what then became similar to colonial agriculture worldwide. When the British took over Ireland and started using it as essentially an agricultural export factory to send pigs and farm produce back to England to support feeding the populace in England, a lot of the agricultural produce from Ireland wasn't available to the people of Ireland, and so they had less the land they had to actually feed themselves on. Got smaller and smaller, and the diet became dominated by potatoes. So then when a potato blight hit and wiped out much of the crop, there wasn't enough food that was allowed to be distributed to the populace. So there's sort of two aspects to it. One was the basic food production problem, and that their primary crop got wiped out. But the other one was the way they distributed food.
And as it pertains to us, what are our great lessons from that as we can look to our future of soil? Are we anywhere near having that kind of a devastating problem again, or for that matter, the Dust Bowl of the Great Depression?
Well, there's a couple of scary lessons there. I think one of the big unacknowledged lessons of the potato famine, which I actually didn't go to very far into the book because it's sort of one step removed from soil,
right,
is the idea of relying on a single crop, relying on a single hybrid. The move toward sort of, proprietary hybrid seeds these days in global agriculture is, and particularly seeds that are sterile, that that cannot produce new generation, so you have to keep buying a proprietary crop from a supplier. We should all be worried about that, because the idea of actually having limiting the genetic stock in our food so that it's vulnerable to a single blight, like what happened to the Irish with potatoes, there's a big lesson there that we've not learned and we're not paying attention to, and that we're going down exactly the wrong track for.
We're not a single crop kind of country, right? I mean, how are we going down that same road?
Well, we're moving to the point of sort of single hybrids in terms of, a single kind of corn, a single kind of other crops, limiting the diversity in the genetic base of a lot of the crops that we have is something that's not, it does not feed resilience in the long run.
Okay. I'm curious about that because I'm not crazy about all of the genetically modified seeds, and I know that there's a huge business interest in that, and I'll never win that argument. But Well, I won't. But I am curious whether there is any lesson from history for people who have gone down that genetically modified seed route, at least in kind of a historical context, where they ended up, you know, in sort of the laws of unforeseeable consequences, ended up shooting themselves in the foot. And are we shooting ourselves in the foot by having all of these designer, you know, patented boutique seeds?
Oh, I think the big lesson...
A little outside of your area of expertise, I know, but I'm curious about that.
I think the big lesson there is that they're relying on a narrowing of the genetic diversity of our food crops is something that's not a good idea. And again, the Irish, I think, are a good example of why that's a bad idea, because you're then vulnerable. A single thing can take you out.
Okay.
And that's not... that.
What's the greatest threat to our soil then right now?
You know, I think it depends what time scale you look at. If I can wear my geologist hat for a minute and talk about the really long term, then the biggest threat clearly is simply the rate of erosion of agricultural soils worldwide. Because I put out a paper last. One of the things I did in researching the book is I went to the library and sort of got all the data I could, the numbers behind the argument that we're losing agricultural soils faster than they're being made by a ratio of something like 20 to 100 to 1. We're losing soils, you know, 20 times to 100 times faster than they're being formed. If you sort of look through thick glasses globally at what's happening to soil, that should worry us all. The good news is that it's happening at a slow rate, an average of a millimeter or so a year. But the bad news is that those kinds of slow crises, if you will, never really come to the forefront of policymakers, you know, crisis du jour. We're not aggressively pursuing soil conservation measures the way that we did in the aftermath of the Dust Bowl, when it was really on the front page of society's consciousness. And there's been great progress that's been made in combating soil erosion since the Soil Conservation Service was established after the Dust Bowl, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service continuing their good work. Has reduced erosion rates in North America dramatically, but they're still well above soil production rates. And so wearing my geologist hat, the biggest threat to agriculture long run is we're running out of dirt, running out of good fertile soil. The good news is it's pretty slow.
Right.
So there's time to actually turn it around. And there's examples from history that suggest that we can turn it around, and there's technologies available today that would allow us to turn it around. Over a shorter term, the biggest threat to adopting those methods is conceivably the rush to biofuels.
The rush to biofuels, meaning the idea of growing these crops to augment gasoline production.
Yeah, exactly. Because many of the ways that, using corn, for example, for ethanol production, corn grown conventionally, sort of plow-based conventional industrial corn production, is one of the more erosive agricultural techniques that are in use today. And so if we embrace that fully for fuel production, then there's a good reason to argue that we may be, in trying to solve our more immediate fuel problem, we'll be aggravating the long-term soil problem.
Okay, I'm thinking about islands you'd mentioned before about Haiti. Wasn't it Haiti that said that once they lose their soil, that's it, then it's gone?
Yeah.
Are there efforts to where you can have like a soil donation program? I mean, we have food that we send to people, right? We have potable water we bring to people. Can you redo soil? Is that something that maybe a future power base for a country would be not its oil, but its soil.
Exporting its dirt.
Yeah.
I think viewed long enough down the road, if we continue losing soil at the rate we're doing it, then those places that still have it down the road will be the power bases. But they won't have the power base by exporting their soil, because energetically it's a lot more efficient to restore soil or to keep soil on someone's field and restore soils than it is to ship it around the world. Because, soil may be our most valuable natural resource, but it's not our most valuable economically. It's dirt after all. It's not very, it's not like gold. You need a lot of it to come up with a high value. And so it probably the economics would probably never pencil out to ship dirt around the world as a donation. But
hold on a second. I wonder whether it would make sense in some cases, because if we sent them soil, then we keep them there. And I don't mean that in a racist sense, but I mean that in terms of like keeping people from migrating to us, is that maybe we just say, hey, look, you know, give a man a fish and he eats for a day. You give, you know, teach him about a fish. And so we say, well, here's soil. Now go start growing your own crops again.
Well, you know, I think the underlying point you're making is a superb one, but that the actual answer would be teach them how to take care of their own soil.
Right.
And give them the tools and the knowledge to enable them to actually do that and feed themselves sustainably. I actually think that is one of the most important global policy initiatives that we're not pursuing that we need to pursue, because if you look at the areas of the world that are going to be most impacted by any kind of future food shortages, a lot of it is going to be the developing world. And you can easily make a case for the impacts on sort of population dislocation and emigration and immigration that might result from that. One of the best long-term investments I think we could make in terms of global assistance is not helping other countries sort of develop industrial agriculture so they can then turn around and use it to generate export income to feed them, to pay off their World Bank debt,
right?
Which is what we do now. But instead, essentially try and direct our development resources towards helping subsistence farmers and the population that are in cities feed themselves with small-scale organic gardens, whether they're urban gardens or whether they're subsistence plots. Give them the tools and the information, the knowledge to be able to grow food for themselves and lift themselves out of poverty. That's the way to keep people from wanting, you know, huge global migrations in response to food shortages from happening. I don't think the energetics and the economics of shipping dirt around the world would ever pencil out. But I do think that it makes a lot of sense to, you know, to use the teach a man to fish analogy, but it's, you know, teach a man to farm sustainably, and then they can,
right,
they can be there. They can, people can stay where they are productively.
What who monitors these things, sorts of things? Is there a UN commission on soil that, you know, works this out, or is it pretty much left up to academics networking through colleges and stuff?
Well, there have been UN-sponsored studies on the problem of soil erosion globally. I know of no body that sort of organizes global policy about, you know, what to do to preserve our global supply of agricultural soils. It's one of those problems that seems to essentially, you know, it's under the radar for at high levels of policy. But the idea that our sort of global security and our national security are tied to food policy and the way we treat the land and the way other countries treat their land over the long run is I think a realization that is starting to dawn on people, how we actually would organize ways to keep track of it and encourage agricultural behaviors that sustain the long-term productivity of the land rather than mind it, really is one of the fundamental challenges we face.
Okay. And I'm thinking about this in terms of both our future, but obviously the future of other people on the planet. Who gets our soil? Who gets when?
Oh, where does all the dirt go?
Yeah, where does the dirt go when it erodes from us? Who gets it?
You know, that's one of those really interesting, almost counterintuitive things. Because if soil erodes off of a field, well, eventually it's going to make its way into the ocean. But if you take studies that have looked at how much sediment's reaching the world's oceans, and you compare them to studies of how much soil is being eroded off of upland farming fields, there's a real disconnect, because erosion rates have increased something like tenfold due to farming activities, or tenfold or more in most places. The Mississippi Basin is a good example. But the amount of sediment that's actually getting to the coast and out into the oceans has been cut in half. So where is it going? What's happened? And the short answer is that a lot of it has ended up behind dams, and they're filling in reservoirs. It's being redeposited on floodplains, and it's being taken from the tops tops of fields on ridgetops and brought down onto the shoulders. It's sort of a slow process of moving soil down to the streams. And so it's all going downhill, downstream, slowly. But a lot of it's getting hung up before it reaches the oceans. Eventually, okay. It'll all end up in the ocean.
The need to have as much, you know, arable land as we can in the United States to grow the kind of food we need in order to sustain us into the future. What do we, as looking ahead in the next, say, 15, 20 years, do we have anything to worry about in terms of erosion for the foreseeable, do we 50 years, 100 years? At what point will what generation is going to have to worry about the possibility of not having enough soil left to farm?
When does the bill come due?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's one of those issues that's probably going to play out fairly slowly in terms of, decades. The big problem, as I see it, is that by the end of this century, there's going to be enough people on this planet that how to feed them, even with all the agricultural land in full production that we have today, is a bit of a problem. And so that you could, it's what we do now is going to sort of set the time frame for when the crisis will occur, I think, in the sense that every acre of lost farmland today brings that date a little closer to the point where it may be very difficult to actually feed everybody. We grow enough food on the planet today to feed the entire population if we divided it up in a way that everybody had equal access to it. But that's a whole different issue.
Right.
And there's strategic decisions that could be made now that could, I think, forestall a crisis ever actually coming to bear. There's one of the optimistic scenarios I could spin is that the adoption of no-till agriculture in the U.S. and in Canada and South America has grown from essentially zero back in the early 1960s to about a third of our cropland today. And what no-till agriculture is instead of plowing the soil, turning the soil over, leaving it bare and vulnerable to wind and rain for some time of the year, which is what increases the erosion rate so dramatically and results in topsoil loss, crop stubble is left on the field and seeds are planted sort of through it with seed drills and other techniques to put the seeds down beneath essentially like a natural mulch, a natural compost, or a natural mulch. Those techniques can actually reduce soil erosion pretty darn near to the rates of soil production. In other words, you could have a totally sustainable agriculture if we changed the way we farm. And gradually, over the last three or four decades, we've been changing in that direction for other reasons, because it's becoming more and more economical to farm that way. So there's cause for optimism in the sense that we may actually be able to learn some of the lessons of prior societies, at least in terms of the net soil loss, how to maintain soil fertility and deal with the problem of a world after petroleum-based fertilizers. That's a whole other question.
Okay. I don't think we've spent enough time actually on some of those civilizations of the past and their problems. So you mentioned before about the Romans. Let's talk specifically about the Roman issues and how they lost their empire and how the soil related to their problems, their political problems. And we'll take a look at some very specific stories coming up here from Dirt, the erosion of civilizations, and then your questions and comments for Dr. David R. Montgomery on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And that was a little music from Big Dirt, the band from David R. Montgomery. Dirt, the erosion of civilizations is the book. Let's go back in time. We'll take a look at some of the other big lessons from histories, civilizations that were brought to their knees because of their treatment of their soil, or at least it played a big part in it. Coming up next, and we'll get to your questions and comments on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, you've been very kind to answer all of my questions, but I am curious about some of these other civilizations we haven't talked about much. You identified Rome as being one that you were following closely in terms of the historical significance of their soil. So, Professor, what can we learn from the Romans?
Well, the Rome's a really neat example of a society where you can actually, they actually have a few books that were written that have survived to this day that we can go back and look at how did they practice their agriculture, what were they concerned about, and what happened to their soil over their history. And in short, what happened was that very early Roman agriculture, sort of in the early days of the Republic, was something that was called cultura promiscua, which is not unlike you know, what we might call permaculture in the modern sense. So there was it was a polyculture where you had they were growing different crops at different levels of a vegetation canopy, so that the ground wasn't really bare and vulnerable to erosion for much of the year. But after the Punic Wars, where the Romans went after their geopolitical rivals, the Carthaginians, and took them out, you know, and famously salted the earth around Carthage to keep them from coming back, they also brought an awful lot of slaves back to Rome in the 2nd century BC. And that's right about the time when, if you look at records of soil erosion from, like, records for when closed lakes filled in, you can drill a core in it, look at how much dirt fell into it over time, and reconstruct that erosion rates in the Roman heartland went through the roof in the 2nd century BC, right about this time where all these slaves came back from Carthage, and Roman agriculture was transformed from these small-scale family farms into large-scale monocultures that were geared towards commodity production, which it's an awful lot like the transformation of agriculture in the United States over the last 100, 150 years. And therein, I think, lies one of the lessons. And what happened is that the high yield production on Roman farms from the 2nd century BC on started to really strip mine their soil, so that by the 2nd or 3rd century AD, you know, 400 or 500 years later, the soils of central Italy were no longer able to feed the populace of Rome, and Rome was deriving quite literally the grain for the bread that was given to the populace of Rome to keep politics in line. It was being grown in Syria, in Egypt, in North Africa, other parts of the empire. So as they exhausted their soils in their core, their agriculture shifted to outlying areas, and that became increasingly unstable. And it was a capital offense, for example, to interrupt the grain shipments from the Middle East to Italy because they were so important for keeping public order in the Roman capital. Mm. So essentially, they overextended themselves, and their demise was obviously not just due to running out of soil in the Roman heartland, but it did influenced the politics of Rome. It influenced their need and reliance on the colonies, the extended bits of their empire. It stretched them pretty thin.
I'm curious about that because I think of the Romans as I guess when you think of farming, you don't think of Rome. I mean, think of the warrior class and out there, you know, all of the things that that Rome did in order to preserve the empire. I'm sort of trying to draw a parallel here to where we are today, and I don't think we're in a danger of that, but that does speak to something like you mentioned about China, and that they might have to go and start invading and annexing and or buying from what used to be rivals or, you know, just appropriating their land in order to keep feeding their massive population, which, you know, when you look at their economy, they have to feed. They you know, they can't depend on capitalism to fix that problem.
Well, yeah, and that's in the end, there is no economic system that will feed people without productive farms, whether it's capitalism or communism or anything. The farms need to stay productive and need to keep up with the population. One of the possible solutions that I think should be aggressively pursued internationally that may help societies that are in danger of eventually looking outside their own borders for sources of new land is the idea of urban agriculture, which is something that is not very well developed. It's almost an oxymoron. I mean, it's in thinking like, well, the Romans, weren't they warriors and not farmers? Well, their society actually depended on farming. But there's a similar oxymoron in terms of thinking about growing food in cities, and yet we can do it. It's been shown to be very effective for helping to feed urban populations.
You're talking about on rooftops, or I mean, where are they going to?
Well, yeah, either in rooftops, parks. Well, actually, in part of China I was in a few years ago, they were growing rice in the traffic strips in the middle of a major road, which, coming from Seattle kind of blew my mind.
Right. But I can't imagine that rice wouldn't be affected by all of the automobile pollution.
Oh, I wouldn't want to eat it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, they every scrap of land was being devoted to food production that was available in the city. There's actually a guy named Will Allen in Detroit who's been pioneering the development of urban agriculture in neighborhoods where there have been abandoned buildings, areas where they're sort of run down. One can convert that kind of land into urban farms. One could even do it with sort of higher tech approaches and urban greenhouses. The idea that we could actually grow a lot of food in cities, whether it's on rooftops or little yard gardens or in neighborhood gardens, is an idea that I think deserves a lot of attention, given that more than half of humanity now lives in cities. We right. used to be, dominantly a species of subsistence farmers, where everyone had their own little plot. Or in the U.S. for many years, the idea had your own the family farm. But globally, we've become a species of city dwellers for the most
sure.
part.
I forgot the statistic. Somebody said at one point, and it wasn't that long ago, like in the 1950s, that still the 70% of the U.S. population was either on the farm or one generation removed from the farm. And that shocked me that it was that recent that the number was that high. And I can't remember exactly what the statistics are, but it's something like that.
Yeah, but, and we're down now to it's like 1% or 2%.
Right. But I want to go back to the point about China. And I know you're saying that that no other, there is no economic system that could take care of this. But I do think it's important to point out that the United States government might not be as at risk as, say, a government like China, which has taken upon itself the feeding of the people. The government doesn't feed the people so much. I mean, obviously, there's a percentage of people that are on, assistance. But other than that, the government's not responsible for it. It's industry. So if there was a problem where the food ran out, I don't know that people would turn against the government right in the same way that they would in China, or like they might in Rome, where that had been that's the people who had been providing it. So that's what I'm saying about China. That would be, that might actually be sort of the seeds of a revolution, if you will, if the food ran out, because that's who'd been controlling it up until this point.
That's my point. Yeah.
And that's, I'm just throwing that out there.
No, and I actually think that viewed geopolitically over the next 100 years or so, if I was one of China's neighbors, I would be nervous.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they have two things that if you're one of China's neighbors, you'd want to keep an eye on your soil, and you'd want to keep an eye on your women, because the disproportionate amount of men in China. That's just a matter of time until they look up and they say, let's just invade this country because we don't have any women left to marry.
Well, and there's also the issue of water.
Yeah, true.
There's proposals. The Chinese are proposing to build a big dam on the Tsangpo River, up which is the headwaters of the Brahmaputra, which is the area that the water grows rice to feed a lot of India.
Right.
There's some interesting geopolitical problems over water and land in that part of the world that we'll be curious to see how they play out this century.
We're talking about the book Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. It's a book by David R. Montgomery. We're not quite yet to taking questions and comments, but we'll get to that coming up. That'll be a whole last hour on Coast to Coast. But as we're talking about soil in this country, too, and the erosion of soil and some of the things that we're going to be facing, are there some, we look at California. And I think, well, gosh, or for that matter, anywhere along the West Coast, you're going to know it better than I am. It's wine. It seems to be, perfect for all types of crops. Will it be possible, should there be more erosion or should there be a shift? Could we ever move on our own, say, you know, some soil out of South Dakota and move it into a new area that had previously been desert or something like that, but because the winds shift or because of the way that the climate changes, this new area is getting a lot more rain, and if it only had soil, we could kickstart it as being farm country. Is that even feasible? Is that even possible to sort of, you know, morph the landscape to create new farming, should we ever have to?
Well, I think in the abstract sense, it probably would be possible, but what you'd need would be a super abundant source of cheap energy to actually cart that much dirt around.
Okay.
I think it's actually, one can restore soil and build new soil. And so that, you know, an alternative approach to doing the same kind of thing, to make good agricultural land in new places under, say, a shifting climate, could be to adapt the practices that we use in treating the land, our agricultural practices and other practices, to try and grow new good soils. There's a place that I think is a good case in point, actually in urban Seattle, called the Inner Bay Pea Patch. It's a piece of land that is a very productive small-scale organic farm at the moment. It's sort of a community-based garden, but they grow a lot of food for food banks and for that's given away to people who don't have access to enough fresh food. And it's built on top of what was an old urban garbage dump. Hmm. So it's like 10 years ago that it was essentially a dump. And they took your suggestion. They hauled in sort of new topsoil from somewhere else, but it was sterilized when it arrived. It had been completely sterilized. So they started essentially from scratch. And now, 10 years later, it's one of the most the yield per sort of hectare, if you will, of food off of that small piece of land is astronomical. Hmm. They grow a lot of food in a small space because it's they've reinvested in the soil. They've turned it into incredible organic rich soil. And so we can actually create new farmland. We can create farmland in cities on top of garbage dumps if we treat the soil in a way that will actually foster the life that's in it and the organic processes that cycle life within it. We can bring back farmland that's been abused, that the soil has been rendered much less productive.
But
there's ways to go about it.
If there's a nuclear explosion, though, and I'm not being facetious, if there's something like that, there probably is no going back.
Well, then you're waiting 10,000-20,000 years.
Right. I mean, honestly, if there's some sort of Armageddon, I think there's a lot of people that imagine that if there's an Armageddon of some sort, that they would be able to, you know, start growing seeds and start being able to grow their own gardens and start to feed themselves. And I'm thinking to myself, if there ever was anything like that, both the air and the soil would be pretty much destroyed for a period of time.
For longer than agriculture has existed on the planet so far.
Okay.
That is an Armageddon scenario in terms of at least in whatever the areas that are affected.
It makes me think of Chernobyl too, and the problems they had as the with the atomic particle drift that was going on in the upper layers of the atmosphere.
Yeah, it doesn't just stay put. It's one of the problems. Yeah.
Okay. Well, and I know I'm going to give you up here in just a second for other people's questions and comments. We're talking about dirt, the erosion of civilizations. But so before we do, any other one of the historical lessons you want to get to that we haven't gotten to yet?
Well, yeah, there's actually a historical lesson that I think is a positive one, and that's the small island of Tikopia. In the South Pacific, and it's a place where they actually practice sustainable agriculture for thousands of years by having a multi-canopy polyculture. So they didn't just grow single crops, they didn't grow monoculture, they grew multiple crops together that provided different layers of a vegetative canopy that shielded the ground from the rain. And thereby prevented erosion, but that also allowed for organic matter to be reincorporated back in the soil. They and the ancient Inca, who had agricultural terraces. They essentially brought their urban garbage back to and put it in all their organic waste. They put it back in their vegetable, in their fields and their terraces. And so they turned erosion off with their terracing by making their fields sort of flat and so and step-like instead of sloping. But they also put organic matter back in their fields. And people had tested the agricultural quality of their soils that they've farmed for 2,000 years, and they're better than the surrounding soils. So I think one of the big lessons from history, obviously with the title of the book, The Erosion of Civilizations, is that if we don't take care of our land, it may end up not being able to take care of us. But the flip side of that is that there are examples where if we do take care of the soil, if we reinvest in it, if we garden it in the sense of tending it rather than mining it, it can sustain us over the long run. We can actually improve soils over the long run. It's just not the standard record of the history of humanity to have done so. It's the exceptions that have.
No, I would agree. I in the time that we have left, I'll say one thing I always thought was really interesting about what you wrote, and I don't have it here in front of me because I read it earlier in the week, is that the bit about how people in Guatemala, was it? I can't remember the country, where they can't get the coffee that they grow there. Is it Guatemala that exports its coffee?
I was visiting Guatemala. It must have been about a decade ago now, maybe even 15 years. And, you know, I'm from Seattle. I love coffee, and I wanted good coffee. And when I was there, I couldn't get local coffee. All we could get was freeze-dried coffee imported from the United States because all the local coffee that was produced there was for export. The locals couldn't get it.
Yeah, and you would think with a crop that valuable that they would be able to trade that for food and make that work for the people who are growing it, but that wasn't my impression.
What that's worked very well for are the large companies that own the land that's good for coffee growing,
right?
But that hasn't. There's an awful lot of indigenous people there still who don't have much land to actually, or they did that used to farm the good, rich valley bottoms that are now in corporate hands, and they've been displaced up into the hills where erosion's a big problem.
Do you have a position on hemp?
A position on hemp?
Yeah.
In what sense?
Well, I mean, as a crop, I mean, I think you mentioned before about tobacco, and I thought, wasn't hemp one of the earliest cash crops of the early Americas, and a really good crop because it grows fast, it grows well, and it doesn't kill the soil?
You know, to be honest, I don't know that much about it. So I'd be hard-pressed to say I have a position on it, but it was a very widespread early crop used in rope and fabrics and so forth. And if what you're saying is true, then it makes a lot of sense that it's a good
erosion one. Fighter. That's all I was thinking. It's just,
and you know I'm not that up on it.
Right. I'm not going to be growing a front lawn of hemp anytime soon. But
I think I'd get in trouble if I tried that.
But I'm curious about because I know you said you were growing other clovers and other things just to try to reinvigorate the soil. It's a conversation that goes on all the time here on the phone. So I guess we can cross the hemp question off the list. If you were going to call that in for David Montgomery, we checked that one. We'll have to move on to some other topics. But go ahead. Your questions, your comments on dirt, the erosion of civilizations, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.